citing free speech rights. A growing amount of evidence points to the dangers of social media for children. Researchers say the addictive platforms incite bullying, substance abuse, and other behaviors, which can lead to self-harm. Schmill says her 18-year-old daughter, Becca, would be alive today if greater protections and regulations on big tech were in place.
We want to do it for our kids, and we want to make sure that no other children die or are harmed by the same design features that have harmed our children.
The Kids Online Safety Act has undergone extensive revisions to earn the support of national LGBTQ plus groups concerned with censorship of content. But groups in more conservative states with restrictive laws remain opposed, along with the ACLU. Still, parents like Schmill say if passed, the legislation will hold social media companies liable for their products and help put the safety of young people over profits.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, May 20th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Reed Johnson. This producer is Reed Johnson, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Jill Freitas, Edwin J. Vieira, and Catherine Carley. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282VH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ezra.
And I'm Reed Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio and have a good night.
From the Coast Range Association, this is Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. About a year and a half ago, we did an episode on a Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, timber sale in Southern Oregon called Poor Windy, as part of our Worth More Standing series highlighting some of the biggest threats to mature and old growth forests on public lands. Recently, community activists set up a tree sit in an old growth grove that was targeted for logging within the Poor Windy sale. And within weeks, they were able to get the BLM to withdraw that part of the sale. So to talk about the tree sit and that victory, I'm going to be joined by Grace Warner of Siskiyou Rising Tide. But first, we're going to hear a short excerpt from my interview with George Sexton from Klamath Siskiyou Wild from that previous episode on Poor Windy, which will help set the scene and context of the issues I'll be discussing with Grace. You can find that earlier Poor Windy episode and our entire catalog for free on any podcast app or at our website, coastrange.org. Okay, let's start the show. I started by asking George to describe the Poor Windy sale and the forests that we're talking about.
I'll take a stab at it. The Poor Windy timber sale is an old growth timber sale that's located on both sides of I-5 in between the towns of Grants Pass, Oregon, and Glendale, Oregon. If folks are familiar with the Sexton Pass area, it's pretty near there. It's a checkerboard land ownership pattern such that half of the lands are owned by managed by the Bureau of Land Management, owned by the American people. And the other half of the checkerboard is owned by industrial timber corporations. And so all of the industrial timberlands have been logged repeatedly, you know, clear cut repeatedly and then sprayed and then planted with timber plantations. And I'd say a little over half of the BLM public lands in that checkerboard have been previously logged and also turned into plantations. So about 75% of the landscape that you drive along when you go through Southern Oregon on I-5 has been previously clear cut and turned into timber plantations. What poor windy timber sale would have targeted is that last 25% of old growth forests that haven't been converted into timber plantation. The planning area was over 10,000 acres in size, and it was going to produce timber volume for the BLM to meet a timber target that they have set for themselves. It's an arbitrary timber target that they assign to themselves in their forest plan. Part of that has to do with the Oregon and California Lands Act and the Bureau of Land Management's interpretation of that act. To contrast the Bureau of Land Management with the Forest Service, because a lot of folks are more familiar with the Forest Service management of public lands. The Forest Service has a multiple use mission. And so timber production is part of what they do, but they also see watershed protection and recreation and wildlife habitat as part of their mission. That's not how the BLM sees their mission. The BLM sees their mission in public lands management is A, produce timber, and then maybe there'll be some other things below that they can accomplish as well. And so particularly for Oregon and California Land Act public lands that are managed by the BLM, timber production is the sole and only goal of the agency. And that really runs into some ecological and social problems when the BLM is proposing old growth timber sales near homes and communities or near I-5 that are going to increase rather than decrease fire hazard. And the primary way they do that is through that conversion of old growth forests, which are relatively fire resilient, into timber plantations, which tend to carry fire with more severity. And that's particularly troublesome when it's occurring, you know, in that checkerboard where you also have homes and ranches and other structures.
Right. I'm glad you gave that context that it's the remaining 25% we're talking about here. It's not X percentage of the whole. We're talking about, you know, what's left already, right? As well as how this is a number and target that the BLM sets for themselves. Could you talk about what's so special about this forest type? Why is it, you know, as we say, worth more standing?
Mm-hmm. Well, the old growth forests that do still remain on public lands provide several values that the timber plantations cannot. The one that most folks are familiar with is the wildlife habitat values of old growth forests. They're simply on another level than the habitat that's provided by even aged timber plantation. But I think that what's becoming more and more important to Oregonians and people in the West in general is fire resiliency and fire management. If you've ever tried to start a campfire, you know that you got to start with, you know, the kindling and the twigs and work your way up to the larger diameter material. And that's because the larger diameter of a piece of wood that you're trying to set on fire, the longer it's going to take you to generate the heat necessary to get that thing to combust, right? And so a 4-foot wide Douglas fir tree is far less likely to experience a stand replacing fire event than is an 8-inch wide timber plantation where the canopy is very close to the ground and can carry that fire. Now, those are tendencies, right? If you get an extreme climate driven, you know, drought along with extreme winds, anything made out of wood burn, you know, and we're seeing more of that too. But those old growth forests help with that as well in that they are carbon sinks, very effective carbon sink. And that's one of the primary reasons that they're worth more standing. A lot of folks also find a great deal of recreational value in old growth forests. And then they're fantastic for watershed values, particularly when they're in municipal watersheds that provide drinking water supply. The old growth forests will moderate water release over time, which helps keep water in the streams and creeks, both for human consumption and for fish.
What are the next steps for you all in this campaign to protect this stand of forest?
Right. Well, we're doing everything that we can in the courtroom and from a legal perspective, but old growth logging and carbon sequestration and fire policy are not going to be settled by the courts or by a judge. You know, this is something that we as a society are going to have to figure out and tackle in this new era of climate catastrophe. And that means we've got to come up with policies and politics that reflect your concerns and the concerns of everyone who owns these public lands. And so I think that the Worth More Standing campaign involves having that discussion about what values old growth forests provide, both for carbon sequestration and fire management and wildlife habitat, and then trying to get those reflected in policy.
Well, Grace Warner, welcome to Coast Range Radio. Thanks so much for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I've already done a previous episode where we went really deep on the wonky details of that timber sale and the work that groups like KS Wild or Klamath Siskiyou Wild and the Western Environmental Law Center have been doing to protect the forests that encompass timber sales like Poor Windy. So I'm not going to ask you to give us all the nitty gritty, but could you just start us off with a quick refresher of the Poor Windy timber sale and why are conservation groups and activists fighting to stop it?
Yeah, totally. The reason why people are fighting this timber sale, well, it's on Bureau of Land Management land, and the BLM has claimed that they're not logging old growth anymore. In the case of this timber sale, there's 4,000 acres of mature and old growth trees that are within the boundaries of this sale. And in the particular unit where people had a tree set, there is actually a grove of old growth pine and cedar and Doug fir that was right in the path of a proposed spur road. So essentially the spur road, it was, you know, sort of a kind of random, and it would have just taken out that whole grove of trees. And so people wanted to stop that.
Yeah. Well, let's get into that then. Like you mentioned, there was recently this successful tree sit blockade that happened in that grove you're talking about. So tell us a little bit more about that. You know, what groups were involved, why a tree sit, and what happened with it?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So for some years, there were conservation groups that were fighting this timber sale. You mentioned some of them at the beginning of the podcast. Those groups like fought really hard using ground truthing and legal tactics to try to stop it. And unfortunately, those tactics were not successful in getting the timber sale dropped. And so direct action folks got involved. It is not one particular group that took that on, but rather a sort of like autonomous group of people that came together to take this action. And what happened was folks just heard that there was imminent logging on this particular spur road and saw an opportunity to bring attention to what the BLM was doing. And it's Boise Cascade, that's the timber company that is logging out there. So, you know, I'm part of a group called Siskiyou Rising Tide. I can talk more about that later, but we're a local group that's worked on forest and climate stuff in the area for almost 10 years now. And we're not like the bottom liners of this situation, but we just heard that friends were going to go out there and try to stop this. And it's right up our alley, and we decided to support it. So we've been one of the groups that's sort of visibly supporting the tree sit, but by no means like the people who are like, you know, organizing it or doing all the work.
Right.
And there's been a legacy of forest defense, you know, both in Southern Oregon and around Eugene. And there was definitely folks who have been involved in all the different iterations of forest defense organizing in the southern half of the state that were involved in this tree sit.
It's so exciting and important to see people kind of re-embracing this tactic of tree sitting, of doing this direct action. Because you can see just from, well, A, we're going to get into, you know, that it actually was successful in its aims, and also the media generated, you know, like it's a lot more exciting for media to cover a tree sit than it is a press release or a lawsuit, which can also be very effective. But yep. I think our forest defense movement has has really skewed towards that like lawsuit heavy focus and rather than just kind of getting out there and being scrappy. And so, yeah, it's exciting to see that being reinvigorated. So talk a little bit more about the tree sit, what happened with it, and the success.
Totally. Yeah. As an aside, I just love forest defense. And I think that tree sitting is a really amazing tactic because of just like the way that it brings people to the point where the destruction is happening and just like helps people actually almost form a relationship with that place rather than it sort of being more cerebral. And the tree sit, there actually ended up being two platforms out there, and they were both in these big old pine trees on the spur road, over 120 feet up in the air. There was a traverse up there, like a line going between them too, that people could move between them. And it was up, oh gosh, I want to say it was like 2.5 weeks or three, not long as far as tree sit campaigns go.
Right.
But folks just went out there and, on federal land, you're allowed to camp for a certain amount of time. So it made it sort of like low intensity to start out with.
Uh-huh.
People taken to the trees. And in addition to people being in the trees, there was also this really wonderful sort of ground camp happening with local folks coming in and out and supporting people in the trees. And people did a lot of media at the same time. We also had an event at the BLM office where people dressed up like birds and kind of disrupted work in the office. The tree sit got different responses at first from the BLM and from Boise Cascade representatives, who at first sort of acted like, who cares if you're here? We weren't going to log this anyways, which they were lying about. And then became more adversarial and sort of trying to convince people to leave. And then within that, the Boise Cascade representative started to sort of mention like, hey, maybe we can formally drop this part of the timber sale. And we had really supportive legal folks involved that could sort of verify what was effective in that way. And eventually we were able to get a contract signed by Boise Cascade officially dropping that part of the timber sale to protect those trees. And that, I don't think I've ever seen something go that quickly, actually. I've been involved in stuff before where people are like in the trees for like a year or more while some like thing gets played out in court. But in this particular case, people really like freaked out, the BLM and Boise Cascade, and they wanted to move pretty quickly to not be seen as logging those trees and also not have to deal with people being in them and what it would take to get people out of there.
Yeah, if only we had some mole on the inside to understand why this moved so fast. Although I should note, in the interest of even-handedness, that the BLM says that the tree sit had nothing to do with them changing the plans. I'd love to get your reaction to that.
Yeah, well, I'm not like, this isn't my first rodeo, and I feel like any effective thing I've ever been a part of, the people in power, if they do change, will always claim that it wasn't because people put pressure on them.
Right.
And that's part of their PR strategy, and they can say that if they want, but it's just, there's no way. I mean, there's just like, I think like context in Southern Oregon, there's just so much logging going on, and the idea that like somebody would have, without like activists like drawing attention to it, that they would have actually like noticed themselves those trees shouldn't be in the timber sale and like had a whole dialogue with Boise Cascade, like that just wouldn't have happened.
Right.
So it was definitely to me a tell that they tried to like they kind of changed their lines about it, like trying to say that it wasn't in the timber sale at all in the first place. Like if that was true, they could have just showed evidence of that, but it was a lie. And then they did end up citing people out there. So, I think they were really wanting people to not be there anymore. And so in this case, it was worth it to them to bend to pressure. I still, the timber sale hasn't been dropped yet, so it's not over, right? And in this case, it was strategic for them to go ahead and drop that section of the timber sale to not have to deal with the protesters being there.
Yeah, quite a coincidence it would be if a tree sit goes up and then all of a sudden, coincidentally, they change the plans to avoid the area that the tree sit is in. That's kind of stretches credulity.
Yeah, yeah.
So I want to, and I will just say as a side note, you know, I never want to assign bad faith to anyone, but when you have the agency out there saying that we are not targeting mature and old growth forests, but, oh, this road just happens to go through these old growth trees that we aren't quote unquote targeting, it makes it a little bit harder for us in the conservation community to be able to believe that the BLM is acting in good faith there. And that's a real sad thing, you know, because we want them to be conservation partners, not adversaries in all this, but seems like maybe we're not quite there yet. I want to ask, unless you have a comment on that, I wanted to ask kind of what comes next for the efforts around this timber sale.
Yeah, well, that's a little bit of like to be announced. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to say that the folks that like worked on this together and also just like our sort of movement as at large as forest defenders, I think this is not just a one place issue. Like there's places that are being threatened all over the state and in Southern Oregon. And so I think right now it's about thinking about like what is our larger strategy in confronting this issue in Southern Oregon and across the state. And I think there's some things in store, and I would just say folks should stay tuned and following Siskiyou Rising Tide and the Tree Sitters Union page in Eugene. Those would sort of be places I would look for what's to come for direct action forest defense.
And so how do people, you know, stay tuned and keep in touch with Siskiyou Rising Tide and the Tree Sitters Union?
Yeah, we both have Instagram pages, and honestly, that's just the best way. That's the best way. I actually don't have Instagram personally, so I always feel bad saying that because like I know not everyone can find that.
Sure. Okay. Well, yeah. So it's just Siskiyou Rising Tide and the Tree Sitters Union both on Instagram.
Yeah. Totally.
Great. Obviously, Poor Windy is not the only contentious logging project on public lands down your way or in the state, but I know there is a lot of stuff happening on those ONC lands down in Southern Oregon. That checkerboard of BLM and private industrial timberlands is always a contentious battleground. So if you have any more forest campaigns that you all are tracking down there, or just other things that Siskiyou Rising Tide is working on that you'd like folks to know about.
Yeah, totally. I'll just give a shout out that there's been a lot of active organizing around the community of Williams, which is in Southern Josephine County. It's south of Grants Pass in the Applegate Valley. And they are in a fight to stop the Penn Butte and Late Mungers timber sale. And there's various community groups. I wouldn't be able to give you the right Instagram handle for that, but to say that that's an active fight that's happening, it's not a ground fight at this moment in the sense that they're being actively logged, but people have been doing everything they can to get those timber sales dropped from BLM land. And then there's also this timber sale that we're keeping an eye out that I don't think has been sold yet called Rogue Gold, which is near Gold Hill, south of Grants Pass in Jackson County. And yeah, so we're just sort of keeping an eye on those things and plugging in where we can. And there will be things to come. Siskiyou Rising Tide, I mean, is it helpful to just hear about kind of like what we're up to these days as a broader group?
Yeah. And you know, some folks, I obviously used to organize with a Rising Tide chapter, but some folks may not have even heard about Rising Tide. So you know what is the mission of Siskiyou Rising Tide? And yeah, what kinds of things are you working on?
Yeah, so Siskiyou Rising Tide, we've been around for almost 10 years now in Southern Oregon. We started as a group to fight the Jordan Cove and Pacific Connector frack gas pipelines. And that's a campaign that, you know, not alone, but with so many community groups across Southern Oregon and in the state of Oregon, that we defeated that pipeline, which is really exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we're part of the Rising Tide North America Network, which that name Rising Tide comes from the climate justice direct action movement. And I think that a thing that happened for us after the pipeline victory, I mean, that happened in the middle of the first year of COVID. And then the other thing that happened in 2020 was that two small towns in Southern Oregon burnt down. literally like Rogue Climate's office burnt down. They were one of the main nonprofits that was helping support communities and fighting that pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
So extremely close to home for all of us who were fighting that pipeline. And as a result, I think we had already as a group been shifting towards just sort of a larger anti-capitalist and abolitionist framework, like fighting against these larger systems of racism and policing and ecological destruction and exploitation. And so when the fires happened, it really just made a lot of sense for us to become oriented around disaster relief. And that happened in a number of ways, mostly just like helping with infrastructure for other small groups that were starting up around that. You know, we actually like helped start a relief fund that was really grassroots and just did stuff like that. And I think that's sort of like, that's kind of what we've been doing the last couple of years. I'm like extremely grateful for the opportunity for our organization to be supporting, as you know, as we continue to sort of support mutual aid that's happening in our community around homelessness, to be able to also be supporting ground fights to stop industrial timber sales. Because I think all of us, like, our hearts are with land defense and really like interrupting the destruction where it's happening. But it's hard, like, you know, when you live in a more rural area, like, you can't just work on one thing. Like, you gotta be a part of all of it. And so, like, it wouldn't really be possible without this sort of like collaborative approach and having friends come from other places and support to, like, for us as a group to be like, we're gonna do a full-on forced defense campaign. And I was just like thrilled to like have this come up. It was like, there was just so much support from our wider community and people coming out of the woodworks who have been wanting to be a part of forest defense and land defense again, but, you know, have just been kind of in survival mode in different ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, that is such an interesting point that you're making. And it brings up for me, like, whether you are organizing in an urban or rural area, you know, we have compounding crises all around us. And, you know, I know that it can feel like you can be pulled in all different directions and kind of always jumping from one thing to the next. And that can sometimes have a negative impact on your organizing, but it can also, I think we don't necessarily appreciate the positive impact that organizing around what is most important in that moment in that community can do for building relationships, you know, regardless of what your like larger societal analysis is. So I don't know if that's what you were saying exactly, but that's what it brought up for me. And I think that's really cool. And, you know, because obviously like the connection between houselessness and exploitationism of all kinds, including climate, like is there, but it's not necessarily like a one degree of separation there. But but it's still, you know, the pressing work that needs to be done. So,
well, and the reality in our community is that the houseless folks get scapegoated for fire a lot, and in a very real sense, and then are also directly impacted by these wildfires when they happen. And, you know, oftentimes it's the cause of homelessness, but also people who were unhoused before the fires, you know, are coming out the other side of it with fewer resources and fewer places to be physically. And it's really horrible and ironic when, like, the actual thing that, you know, the actual thing that's driving these fires is climate change. And, you know, these big industrial timber sales, they increase the risk of fire around our rural communities and just make survival during climate change harder, you know, with the water temperatures growing, going up and things like that. And so I think to me, it like is very close together in the sense that when there's crisis, people get scapegoated and oppressed even more. And then we have to like look to who's actually doing the harm here and call attention to that.
Well, that's really well put. Thank you for that. As we wrap up here, is there anything we missed or anything else you want to make sure gets included?
I don't think so. I think we covered it pretty good. Yeah.
All right. Congratulations to all the folks down there on the successful tree sit. Hopefully, you know, this is kind of the beginning of a really reinvigorated scrappy forest defense I would say, arm of the movement, right? We need it all. And if we rely too heavily on any one, you know, piece, then we're missing out on important tactics and strategies. So we will definitely link to the Siskiyou Rising Tide and Tree Sitters Union Instagram in our show notes. And if folks have questions about getting involved, I'm happy to connect any of our listeners with organizations like yours or others doing work on the ground. And you can just go to our website, coastrange.org, or email me, michael@coastrange.org, to learn more. But for now, Grace Warner, thank you so much for joining me today. And thank you so much for all the hard work you're doing down there.
Thank you.
And that's it for today's episode of Coast Range Radio. If you want to learn more or get involved in forest defense in the Northwest, you can find links and resources in the show notes of our podcast or on the Coast Range Radio tab at the top of our website, which is coastrange.org. Our website is a wealth of information on all things Coast Range and forest related, including our campaign to protect the Siuslaw National Forest from a potential Forest Service effort to undermine mature and old growth protections in that forest. Once again, that website is coastrange.org. My email is michael@coastrange.org. You can drop me a line anytime and let me know what you think of the show or if you have any questions. Thank you so much for listening to Coast Range Radio. We'll be back in a couple weeks.
Hey, what's up, everyone? It's Greg McVicar, creator of Undercurrents, and this is KBOO 90.7 Portland.
Cable Community Radio is listener-sponsored. That's right, 80% of our funding comes from donations from listeners just like you. Right now,